Good evening, good afternoon, good morning. It's TMS Roundtable Global Live on Facebook. I had a little bit of an unexpected thing happening, and I thought, here's my opportunity to respond to something I didn't expect rather than react. So, short of getting a rash or a pimple or a stomach ache or stutter, I thought, here's my opportunity. Rose, had something came up unexpected and she is running late. And I thought, and Dr. Schubiner is going to be late with the patient. I thought, I am on my own. And here I thought, call Michael Galinsky. You know, and I thought, no, Tova, you can do this. So thank you for the opportunity for me to learn a lesson. And great, you're here. Dr. Howard Schubiner, Baruch haba, as we say, welcome to our show. Good evening. Good
Thank
afternoon.
you.
Right. It's 3 o'clock, right, in Michigan?
3 o'clock in Michigan, and there's always every day brings an opportunity to respond to the world. Everything that happens is an opportunity to respond, and we're always being tested, I guess, little by little, whether
What's
it's
happened to you? What's happened to you in the past couple of days where you've said, I can react to this or I can respond.
Well, I've been the last this past week, couple of weeks, I've been getting these bites. I don't know. We think they're spider bites. And so there's been a lot of itching, and I've been playing with the idea of how itchy I am or need to be, or how
So
much scratching I
distracts
do.
you. It distracts you. It kind
I
of takes
know.
you out of the moment.
I know, and it's sometimes better and sometimes worse, and it's one of those things that fortunately I'm pretty sure it's gonna go away. It hasn't yet, but it's gonna go away. And what I always say is that most people can tolerate really difficult situations if they know they're temporary.
Very good.
I
Now,
mean, why
what?
would women have babies more than once? It's
Right.
astounding.
Okay. But
But
if you
if it's
believe,
something that, but if you have something that's mild, thing can be completely intolerable if you think it's going to last forever. So,
right.
that's one of the beauties of mind-body work, is we can tell people you're going to get better.
Right. And what like in a sort of fast food way, which is not really chronic pain, but for example, you were getting spider bites and you were frustrated because you couldn't figure out what it was. I mean, bed bugs, spiders. So what was the feeling you felt? Were you frustrated? Were you just annoyed? Did you notice that you felt angry or felt uncomfortable? What was the feeling that you felt that you had to just look at and move and detach yourself?
Well, it wasn't that so much. It was more having to detach from the physical experience of
Right,
the
right,
itchiness. That
right.
was what I had to detach from, and
Right.
the urge to scratch.
Right, right, right.
That was morbid. I wasn't angry at the spiders, they're
Right.
living their lives.
A little bit of like I can't control those things, so let me control what I can control. So let's go
Right.
back to what you were just saying. If something is long term, and if we don't believe it's going to go away, don't we need to have the belief first? Because the thoughts are saying it's forever, it's forever, it's never going to go away. So if I can just believe that my body can and mind can work together to make it go away, wouldn't that be the first tip?
Yeah, when we start seeing people,
Here she comes. Hold that note for a minute. Okay, wait, I think Howard froze for a minute. You there?
Yep, I'm here.
Good. Okay, good. Welcome, Rose.
Hi, Tova. Hi, Dr. Schubiner.
Hello.
Hi.
So go ahead, continue.
I was just saying that the first thing that we do is we assess people, in medical terms, We diagnose people.
Okay, then what?
So what we're doing is, you know, is this a mind-body problem? Is this a neural circuit problem, so to speak? And if it's a neural circuit problem, then it can go away. So there's a certain amount of liberation and freedom that comes with understanding what the problem is when it's clear, when it's clearly that's what it is, and when you can clearly and compassionately communicate that. So that's the first step that we always start with, and that often is one of the most important ones.
Right. Can you elaborate more on that? So we do a diagnosis. We see that the person has a mind-body condition or even a physical, structural, permanent condition, but mind-body work can always help the response.
True. But, you know, if the condition is permanent and physical, it's likely that it's going to continue. There's going to be some part of it's going to continue, and you may be able to cope with it better. So mm-hmm. We make a somewhat arbitrary split between coping and curing.
Okay.
So when someone has a mind-body condition, which is most of the time with chronic pain, we're going to a curing mode because the assessment suggests that they can and will get better. If I think it's a structural problem, then we go more toward the coping model. So you can still use mind-body techniques for structural problems, no doubt about it. But most of the time, most of the people who seek my advice don't have a structural problem. And so that's the first step. The second step is communicating that and educating people about the nature of the brain, about mind-body conditions, and about what they have and what they don't have and why it happens. So that's a whole endeavor in and of itself. And I've spent 18 years learning how to do that better over time.
Rose?
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because this is one of the things, the sticking points that the people bring up in the chat, that they've been to 25 doctors and not get a diagnosis. And I thought, how can a doctor actually turn it around and allow the patient to see that it's anxiety that's causing it?
Yeah. Well, the doctor has to be aware of the condition. And frankly, most doctors are not. That's why she's been or he's been to 20 different doctors. Because every doctor is looking at it from their point of view, and their point of view is often myopic, in the sense that they don't really understand the power of the brain to produce symptoms that are real, but not due to structural abnormalities. You know, we've done studies on this, and in our back pain study of the 45 people I evaluated, I was certain that 43 of the 45 with chronic back pain had nothing wrong with their back.
Wow.
That's a pretty high number. That's 95%.
Yeah. Well, you've done quite a bit of research in that area now, haven't you?
Well, we're little by little, we're trying to do as much as we can. I'm doing a study right now with a physical medicine rehab doctor in Louisiana, who I love and who I'm horrified about the hurricanes that keep coming to his town. But eventually, hopefully, we'll be able to finish this study. And we're doing a back pain study, and we're going to determine very carefully and over some probably at least 200 people, how many people of the 200 that are coming to a regular doctor, not a mind-body doctor, a regular doctor for chronic neck or back pain, how many of them have actually something wrong with their neck or back? And it'll be really important to know that number in that population anyway.
Yeah. Well, I suppose with all those hurricanes down there, there's probably more people with back pain as well. Do you think?
There's no shortage of people with back pain.
We've noticed.
85% of Americans get back pain at some point in their life.
Right, exactly. Go ahead, tell your story. Tell your favorite story, and then I'm going to ask a question.
Just one of my favorite stories about back pain is that I once asked a friend of mine who was a young doctor from Iraq what he thought was most interesting when he came to practice medicine here in the U.S., and he said back pain. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, people in Iraq don't come to the doctor with back pain. Maybe they have back pain. He doesn't know, but it's not a common complaint.
Wow.
People may come with other things, and stress may cause other symptoms in Iraq than back pain.
Right.
But here, back pain is one of the most top two or three causes of visits to physicians.
Well, you know about the whiplash syndrome, that it only happens in certain countries.
Yeah, same thing.
Same thing. Okay. So because you only have an hour, you told us, I want to say, first of all, to our listeners, and we're so grateful that all you people are here, that Rose and I set up a TMS Roundtable Talks discussion page on our Facebook. And if Dr. Schubiner can't answer your questions in this hour, you can post them there, and I'll send a few to Dr. Schubiner, and he'll answer what he can, or Rose and I will help you answer, because we want everyone to get their needs met emotionally, and I know your time is precious, so I will start asking some questions, okay? Okay, Rose and Dr. Schubiner?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I know that Scott from England, I will answer his question. He first answered, this is his specific symptoms, which you can address, but he did first question above that was, you know, how do you know it's a mind-body condition? And then another person kind of said, like, how do you know when something can't disappear? Like, can you distinguish, you know, the conditions to the people that it's mind-body and it's, you know, how do you take that? And here's his specific question. I've had pain at the base of my skull, the jaw, the temples, and the tinnitus since May 5th, 2011. In a lecture, you introduced a woman who had pain like mine for 25 years, who you had cured. How did she heal? Or jogging your memory, Dr. Schubiner.
Well, I don't heal. I don't cure anybody. They heal themselves.
Or God cures. God cures. Thank you.
Well said.
But, you know, how do you know when it's a mind-body problem? Well, you have pain at the base of the skull. Well, what's wrong there? You know, have a doctor look, take an x-ray. You have a fracture of your skull? Probably not. Do you have tense muscles? Yeah, you have tense muscles, but tense muscles are caused by the brain. You know, take an MRI of your neck, you know, see what's wrong. You know, these are just standard routine tests. You have pain in the jaw? Fine, take an x-ray, take an MRI. You know, look for any tooth problems, sinus problems, ear problems. You know, it's not hard to find those things. And so if someone's had pain since 2011, that's 9 years. That's a long time to have pain. But it's also a long time to not be diagnosed with anything particularly wrong. And so if you haven't been diagnosed with anything clearly identifiably structurally wrong, then by definition, that becomes a mind-body condition. It's not that hard, you know, to figure that out. It's not some divination or special knowledge that only I have. It's just common sense. Ruling out, it's two steps. One, ruling out a structural problem, just what I said, by taking x-rays, MRIs, looking for any particular source of disease. The second step is ruling in a mind-body condition. How do you do that? Well, I'm going to send you, if you can post on your website or your Facebook page, a little thing we put together, what we call a symptom pattern checklist. And what we're doing is we're saying, well, has no one been able to diagnose it? Does the pain shift? Does it sometimes here and sometimes here in your body? Does it move? Does it vary in intensity during the day? Is it triggered by innocuous stimuli such as cold, heat, light? Is it worse with stress? Does it go away when you're engaged in other things? There's all these clues that anybody who's worked in this field will know and has seen. And so you have to pay attention to those clues. You don't want to disregard them. You want to, because they give you the evidence that there's nothing structurally wrong when the pain can turn off when you're on a boat, or it can be triggered by stress or sense.
And you've met people, you've had patients with enormous traumas from childhood that we don't have to go into detail, and you've seen them get better from the work that we're all doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first step is making the diagnosis, ruling out a structural, ruling in a neural circuit or a mind-body condition. The second, and you know, I write about these. All my books are about that, basically. It's all, that information is all in there. The second step is educating yourself on mind-body conditions and how the brain does what it does, which can give hope and optimism that you're going to get better. And the third step is doing what we're now calling pain reprocessing therapy, which is lowering fear, interrupting the vicious cycle that's reinforcing pain, which is pain leading to fear of pain, leading to more pain. Pain leading to more focus and paying attention to pain, leading to more pain. Pain leading to being frustrated with the pain, leading to more pain. Pain leading to fighting the pain, leading to more pain. Pain leading to try to fix the pain.
Judging yourself for having the pain, that you can't get rid of the pain yourself.
Exactly. Putting more pressure on yourself in many, many ways. Right. And so when we try to strip away that and we begin to see the pain as a protector, a helper, a frightened part of our brain. If you have a child who's lying in bed afraid of a monster in the closet, you're not going to get mad at the child. You're not going to yell at them. You're not going to make fun of them. You're not going to blame them. You're going to treat them with kindness. You're going to treat them with caring. You're going to say, look, there's no monster in the closet. See? Which is what you do to yourself when you say, see, there's nothing wrong in my body. Right? You're opening the door. Saying, look, there's no monster in the closet. And you're doing the same with yourself. You're saying, look, there's nothing wrong with my skull. There's nothing wrong with my jaw. There's nothing wrong with my back or my stomach. That's opening the door to say, see, there's nothing wrong. And then you're going to be kind and caring. You're going to soothe the fearfulness because it's your brain is afraid. Pain is a protector. It's not a betrayer. And then you can soothe that brain and calm it and begin to practice joy and begin to do what you want to do in life and focus on your meaning and purpose instead of trying to get rid of the pain. You don't have to get rid of the pain. You have to get rid of the fear of the pain and the focus on the pain. And you have to begin to re-engage in your life with as much joy and optimism and hope as you can. And that's what turns off these neural circuits of pain. And doing that doesn't really even deal with emotional trauma, right? It doesn't deal with child abuse or neglect. It doesn't deal with neighbors or relatives who are fighting with you. Not to say that you don't have to do that, but you don't necessarily have to do that. It might be helpful, it might be useful, and that's sometimes part of the treatment, but not always. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's sort of getting rid of the symptoms rather than allowing the person to see that the symptoms are about their anxiety rather than solving all the problems. Is that what you're saying, I think?
Correct. Some people feel like they have to find the key, the emotional key. And sometimes that's true, and that certainly can be the case, but it's not always the case. So that's why we have a layered approach. The first layer is the assessment and diagnosis. The second layer is the pain science, neuroscience education. The third layer is the what we're calling pain reprocessing, which you can find on Alan Gordon's podcast, Tell Me About Your Pain. It's a beautiful description of those things. And then the fourth thing is dealing with the emotions, doing emotional processing, dealing with trauma, dealing with current life stressors.
Right.
Those are all valid, sometimes necessary, not always.
Right.
And the fifth thing then after that, and we could talk about that forever, but there's many different ways of doing that. Mm-hmm. And the final thing is living your life, is making whatever changes you need to make in your life to create and reinforce meaning and purpose and social relationships. And a lot of people had trouble with that step in this pandemic because a lot of things have shut down, or
right.
some pathways to doing things, working, volunteering, socially connecting have been curtailed.
Right, it's true. So yeah. I will share this question from someone we know very well and is working very hard with her chronic pain syndrome. And I guess maybe you can think about cases that you had that were really tough for you and for the person because it had been going on for so long. So here's a woman from Switzerland. You know, she's had chronic nausea for 25 years. And even though there's a diagnosis, it's said incurable. What should she do with the information? There are many talks about pain. In other words, she wants to know if there's a possibility for her to believe in that it could go away and get better.
Well, what's, you know, I guess I have to ask, what's the diagnosis?
Rose, what was it again? It was the paralysis of the stomach.
Yeah.
Gastroparesis. So, so the question is, and that's, you know, it's somewhat of a difficult one, I would say, because there's testing that usually, you know, she's talking about gastroparesis, I'm guessing, which is delayed gastric emptying.
Yeah.
And it's hard to know how much of that is just in and of itself is the brain and how much is this. And I think that really has to be taken case by case. And I would ask a variety of things. One is, does she have a lot of different other symptoms or other disorders, you know, history mm-hmm. of anxiety and depression, irritable bowel, headaches, jaw pain, chest pain, etc. So the more of those other things, the more likely this would fit into another mind-body condition. That's one clue. Another clue is beginning to look at, I know she says, well, the pain doesn't quite move around. It's always in the same place. But does it vary? Is there variation? Is there variation based on time of day or day of the month or season or weather or, food or what she eats or whatever? And so a lot of times being an investigator, you can begin to gather evidence of it being variable. And the more variable you can find it to be, the more you can be confident in a mind-body a diagnosis.
Very good. Excellent. And there's so have you had cases of gastroparesis that have improved?
I have.
Good.
Yeah. Well, it's smooth muscle anxiety, if you want to sort of look at it clinically, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there's every bit of reason to know that our brain can affect our body. And we know that, and that we see that every day. We see that all the time. And so in general, that's obviously true. But in any specific case, you have to, I think, the best way to go is to gather the evidence in yourself, you know, with someone you can trust and see what's going on.
Yeah. So, Dr. Schrubiner, I'm going to throw my weight around a little bit here and ask you a question that we might disagree, but of course we can agree to disagree because it's a round table. And because the next question involves that, have there been studies of treatment modalities focusing on people with arthritis pain rather than back pain? So I saw in one of your workshops that some things you don't treat with body, I mean, I didn't read exactly, but that you don't really treat rheumatoid arthritis or a few things like that. And what I want to know is what we actually said in the beginning. Someone can have a chronic pain with a structural diagnosis, but they can benefit from the body, mind, pain methods and insights that all of us are studying and sharing with our clients and our patients. Can we agree on that?
Well, I would say there's three kind of basic models of arthritis. One is rheumatoid arthritis, or an arthritis that's inflammatory in nature. And people with rheumatoid arthritis, when they're having a flare of rheumatoid arthritis, it's an inflammatory condition, and that's a structural problem. So in that situation, my general advice would be, let's do treatment for inflammation, medical treatment for inflammation. There's a lot of good treatments we have out there nowadays, and use mind body on top of it, so you can do both. Clearly, that's great. Secondly, is just because someone has rheumatoid arthritis doesn't mean that all their joint pain is due to inflammation. You can have inflammatory pain due to inflammation, and then the brain learns that. And then over time, your brain is creating joint pain even when you don't have a flare of inflammation. And that would be mind-body pain. For example, people have pain when the weather changes. That's mind-body pain, in my view. So that's an inflammatory arthritis. Now you have a second area of arthritis, which is arthritis that's on an x-ray but isn't actually the cause of pain. That's mind-body pain, because everyone has arthritis on their x-ray. And there's large studies show that there's very little correlation between the amount of arthritis on an x-ray and how much pain someone's having. So if you're diagnosing arthritis based on the x-ray, you could be making a mistake. These are people with what I'm not inflammatory arthritis, but osteoarthritis, the normal quote, wear and tear arthritis. So I've got a lot of osteoarthritis in my neck and in my back, but I don't have pain there. So that's because as you get older, you get x-ray evidence of those changes. And again, the way you diagnose that is by doing that rule in part, looking at the pain. Is it worse with the weather? Is it worse with innocuous stimulus? If it hurts when you bend over, imagine bending over. If it hurts when you imagine bending over, that's another clue that it's your brain and not your back or your shoulder or your knee or, you know, whatever it is. So the second category. Then there's a third category of osteoarthritis, wear and tear arthritis, where it is causing significant damage. Some people have enough damage to their knees or hips where they actually need a joint replacement. And again, you can identify that by the consistency of the pain, the severity of the pain, the findings on the x-ray that is not just wear and tear arthritis, but clearly, severe arthritis. So
yeah,
those are the three areas.
And there's great joint replacement things now that, you're going to sort of never have a stiff joint with the new technology, like the new way of doing hip replacement is sort of teasing the muscle apart and going in that way rather than cutting the muscle. So
right.
Technology has sort of enabled people to have a new joint without all the suffering that they used to have once upon a time. Yeah.
Right.
Dr. Hanscom, who was a spinal deformity surgeon, he got so frustrated because he would change their spine and some people would get better and some wouldn't. So he saw that the mind body played a part. So I think we can agree that if I was to get my hip replaced, my response to the whole surgery will determine my prognosis, how I respond, how I feel about my doctor, how I feel about myself, how I feel about my body and so that's where I think we can all agree on, right, Rose?
Yeah. That's well, Karen Neaton in our other program talked about recovery room.
Yeah.
And how the patients with an emotional problem in recovery room, when they addressed the emotional issue, the pain went down. Right. And I mean, that's after surgery.
Right. And
hopefully there'll be some research on that done too.
Right.
Yeah. We've got some very good questions here.
Yeah.
Seen some of the questions here.
Okay. Here's another question from Yula, who's in Canada. Do you have an answer why we get problems in different parts of our body? Why one person TMS is in the neck, another in the jaw, and someone's in the back?
Good question.
Yes. I have an answer, and no, I don't have an answer.
we'll give you 20 seconds.
Okay. So No, we don't know. We can't know 100%. We can't know exactly what our subconscious mind is doing and why it's doing it. On the other hand, we can surmise sometimes. Sometimes pain is symbolic. You can have pain in the neck when there's someone in your life who's pain in your neck. So it can be symbolic. It can be contagious. You can get pain when, you know, you've seen other people with that pain. You've read about that pain, and then your brain just latches onto that.
Wow.
Three, it can be due to an injury. You had an injury somewhere in the past, and now your brain has learned that pain from the past injury, and now it's recreating it. The fourth is it runs in your family. So if you have a parent who gets headaches, your brain would be likely for your brain to create headaches when you get stressed. And fifth, it can be what I call mechanical, where you're using a certain part a lot, and then your brain just latches onto that and causes pain in that region. So if you're typing a lot, your brain may cause hand pain. If you're bending a lot, it might be back pain. If you're looking at a computer a lot, it might be eye pain. So that's my answer. But you can't say that just because someone has back pain, it means that they have a X, Y, or Z particular life issue. You don't know.
Isn't most RSD, or what they're calling now CR, comes from someone who injured something, and then there's just a chronicness in the pain? It becomes hypersensitive. Isn't that usually what happens?
Yes, but it's not even an injury in the area where the pain is. You can have
it's in the nervous system.
You can have a knee surgery. You can have a knee surgery and start getting CRPS in the foot.
Yeah.
You're right. So Gail has a question. Thank you. It was a good answer that you didn't have to think about too long. Very good. How can you assist someone who has nerve entrapment damage from surgery and procedures 24/7, pain for many years? We'll wait till Dr. Schrubiner unfreezes. Are you there with us? There you go.
Am I okay? I can see.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a freeze, a little bit of delay, which I spoke to. Anyway, there's a little delay because we're codependent on the internet gods of the universe. Go ahead.
So the question is, someone may have nerve entrapment in the past or damage from surgery in the past, but the question is that the cause of the pain now? And again, that requires careful attention to what the symptoms are, how they change, if they change, if they vary, etc. And if there is, the other thing is to know, is there evidence of any kind of nerve damage? So if someone has pain in a nerve area, if the nerve is damaged, it would be likely that they wouldn't have only pain, they would also have inability to feel, decrease sensation, or decrease muscle strength, and or change in the reflexes associated with that area. So it's kind of unlikely for someone to have a nerve, quote, entrapment or damage if the only symptom is pain. So again, it's hard to make that distinction. Med, and I don't really know where the pain is or whatever, but if we look carefully, it may be that the pain now is not actually due to nerve damage. I mean,
we're with you. Can I add to that and say, is when there's nerve damage, isn't it, there's part of the nerve that can be damaged, not the whole nerve. There's certain parts of the nerve. Like if a nerve is severed, that's a nerve severed. But is it possible that the nerve is damaged partly?
Right, but which parts? You know, I mean, the nerve fibers, the pain fibers, the sensation fibers, the muscle fibers, they're all very close. We're not, you know, they're not like, you know, one's on one side and one's on the other side. side. They're all interwoven, mm-hmm. really. And so it's just unlikely for it to be, you know, just pain. A lot of times people, doctors just presume that the pain is due to a nerve when it's not. Like pudendal neuralgia is a good example of that, where people say, well, your pudendal nerve in your pelvis has been damaged and it's causing pain. But there's no evidence that it was damaged. And it's just having pain and nothing else. So, you know, every individual case is different. Everybody has to, you know, figure out for themselves and with the help of doctors, of course. There are not enough TMS doctors in the world to, you know, to help people. Unfortunately, we're going to be training hopefully hundreds or thousands of in the next couple of years.
Good.
But.
Great. So this is a biggie. I do find that my fibromyalgia patients, you know, actually are difficult to help. It's a difficult. So this gentleman or this woman, anyway, welcome. Can fibromyalgia be helped?
Yes. Fibromyalgia is a mind-body condition. Fibromyalgia is a neural circuit condition. When it's appropriately diagnosed, it means chronic widespread pain with no evidence of tissue damage in the body, which is the classic definition of what Dr. Sarno called TMS and what we sometimes call psychophysiologic disorders, or we call neural circuit disorders or mind-body disorders.
Do you find that your fibromyalgia patients are a little bit more tough to deal with? Do you find that?
No.
Okay, good.
I mean, that, you know, everyone's an individual. Everyone's
right.
different.
Right.
And what causes people to be, quote, more difficult or less difficult is not what the manifestation of this danger signal in their brain is causing, whether it's causing insomnia or fatigue or fibromyalgia or headache or nausea. That's not what distinguishes them. What distinguishes them in terms of being, quote, difficult is their level of fear, is their level of worry, is their level of focus. Right? That's one thing that distinguishes it. And then to some degree, of course, they may also be distinguished by their level of trauma.
Right. Yeah. So the same person asked what method can help it. And I think that the method you just said, the five factors, you know, your book, I don't think anything's different about fibromyalgia than it is. Is that correct?
Yeah. Correct.
So, Susie.
Rose was going to say something.
I'm sorry, Rose?
Yeah. Rose was going to say something. I just want.
No. Susie, Batova's brought her question up.
Yeah.
Because to weakness, pins and needles, and the mind body always talks about pain. So, we're using pain. Like, cancer patients will say they're not in pain, but you'll know by their face that they are, and you know that there's some pressure in their body, but they're not reading it as pain. So yeah. We've all got different ideas of pain. So I think that we use the word pain very loosely, don't we?
Yeah, it doesn't matter if someone describes their sensations as pain or not, or numbness or shock.
Yeah.
It's the question of what's causing it is what's most important.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
You know, if it's weakness, if it's fatigue, if it's brain fog, there's an article in the paper today about, you know, hundreds or maybe thousands, who knows how many people who are post-COVID who have brain fog.
Wow.
And concentration problems and memory problems. And so, you know, nobody knows what that is due to. Is there something special about COVID that causes this? You know, was it an inflammation in the brain? Or is it a mind-body condition that's post-mono, you know, or Lyme disease? Mm-hmm. These are conditions that we see all the time that are mind-body conditions. And so it wouldn't be surprising if people post-COVID-19 have mind-body fatigue or brain fog or weakness.
From the trauma of having COVID and the trauma of what's correct. Going on in the world.
Yeah. Correct.
Wow.
And what it means to the person personally, what their losses are and regret and all those other systems.
Correct.
Exactly.
It's very complicated within each person. There's many factors that come into play, but it's a very simple concept.
Yeah.
You know, fear and being endangered, being threatened and physically or emotionally or both, activate a danger alarm mechanism in the brain that alerts us. This danger alarm mechanism is our friend, just like a smoke alarm is our friend to help to alert us to what's going on emotionally or physically. And, so our job is not to look at the symptoms as a betrayal, not to hate them, but to be curious about them, to be compassionate with them, understand. And there's an article again I just saw yesterday, compassion, you know, self-compassion changes how the brain operates. Joy changes how the brain operates.
The biology of gratitude. The biology of hope.
Right.
One of your comments somewhere that I read was, "Don't shoot the messenger. Be kind to the messenger." And I thought that is so true. You know, and if we love the messenger, well, the messenger will take us to our problem.
Yeah.
Right.
One of my favorite authors, Norman Cousins, wrote a book about the biology of hope.
Sure. You know? Absolutely.
So it's a biology of hope, compassion, gratitude. Rose, you want to repeat what? Fabian's question? Fabian's from Germany. She's got a question. Can you see it?
Yeah, do you recommend a particular method to get rid of conditioned response? Actually, that is one of the questions that I had thought about asking you, that whole anticipatory idea that it's going to be a problem, that I'm going to have a problem. Yeah. Can you sort of elaborate a little bit on that for people? Because there's this anticipation that, as you said before, if I bend down, I'll have a problem. So even the thought of bending down, creates a problem.
Right. And that's how, to me, that's the solution. One of the solutions for a conditioned response is to visualize yourself doing the activity. Close your eyes and imagine doing that activity, whether it's bending or driving or going to work or going to a relative's house. Imagine that and see how you feel. Oftentimes, when you imagine going to that situation, whatever it is, your brain will get afraid and react because imagining it is kind of like doing it. And so you may get a little tension or anxiety, or you may get discomfort. You may get pain. And when that happens, then you're in a great shape because then you can laugh and smile and calm your brain and see that your brain is afraid of bending. It's not that bending is the problem, it's the fear of bending. And you just proved it by imagining it and seeing your brain's response in your body. And so if you get tension in your chest when you imagine bending over or driving, whatever it is, then you can observe that tension and breathe with it and smile at it and calm your brain and let it pass. And then imagine doing the activity again.
Excellent.
Tension. And then you want to imagine doing the activity with joy. You want to say, "Oh, this is so great. Look, I'm imagining bending over with joy and peace and happiness and a big smile on my face. And I'm imagining driving. I'm imagining going to work with this lightness in my step." And then you want to take that to the actual doing of the activity. Then you want to, if it's bending over, you want to bend over 10%. With my hand. You want to bend over 10%. with that joy, with that calming, with that soothing, and then 20%, and then 30%. And so you're gradually training your brain out of this conditioned response.
I was just wondering, in that concept, you know, you're driving to work, but there's a bully at work. So you get your pain before you get to work. So there's another component that we maybe need to address in this conversation, and that is how to cope with the bully, for example, so that the pain will go away. Because the pain, as you say, the pain's a messenger. The pain's a messenger that I'm going to be having to face, what, standing up for myself, or acknowledging that I need to get another job, or whatever, you know, like that other area. Because there's no joy when you know you're going to be facing, you know, a call center, for example, and you're working in a call center, and you know you're going to get all these complaints day in and day out, and then you, just the thought of going to work is going to create some sort of pain, arthritis, whichever pain it is, whatever your favorite pain is, I suppose. So can we just talk about that a little bit, about changing our lives, or understanding that where this pain is being the messenger?
Yeah, well, if when there's a clear emotional situation that's going on, then you get to the fourth step, which is dealing with emotions, dealing with emotional situations. And so we use one of the things so I studied ISTDP with Alan Abbas, and I wrote a book with him about this, and for professionals, called Hidden from View. And we, Mark Lumley and I, developed an offshoot of that called EAET, Emotional Awareness and Expression Therapy. And we also use internal family systems. So there's a variety of therapeutic techniques. A lot of people use lots of other ones, EMDR people can use, et cetera. But there's a lot of therapeutic techniques to deal with the emotions. The first step is recognizing what's the emotion.
What I'm talking about, that recognizing that it's bully, about.
If there's a bully at work, then you want to be able to recognize, I am angry, right? This is not, I have resentment. First step is saying, I am angry. Just doing that can be a beginning of a liberating step.
Exactly.
Second thing is to work out the emotions toward that person. And so, you know, again, in my books, there's descriptions of how to do that. Simply put, you may choose to imagine doing whatever the anger wants to do toward that person, to honor that anger. You may want to cut off his head. Fine. So next time you go to work, every time you see him, you see, oh, he doesn't have a head.
Good visualization.
Excellent.
There's no head there. I'm making fun of it, but I've seen people do that. And so what you want to do is allow the anger to come, not in real life, because you get thrown in jail when you do anger in real life. But if you hold anger in, it's just hurting you. So you want to let the anger out in a healthy way by imagining doing it. And then you want to take deep breaths and let it go, because hanging on to the anger is not what you want. You want to express it. You want to let compassion for yourself. Maybe pity for the other person sometimes. Maybe there's compassion for the bully, depending on the situation. Maybe you do have to certainly look for another job or whatever if it's untenable. Or maybe you can just, you know, practice loving kindness and meditation and practice letting go. And practice not allowing this person to take up space in your brain, because they probably don't. They don't allow. They shouldn't be allowed a large part of space in your brain. Because if you continue to be angry at somebody, they're not going to change, but it's hurting you. And so there's a variety of ways of dealing with that that are, you know, often can be critical.
Yeah. Well, I think that's sort of one of the most important things for people to notice. What's going on behind the scenes, rather than what's happening up front, you know, and you've explained it really well, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Excellent. Here's another question. You want to read it, Rose, from Julie?
Which one? Okay. There's one from Susie as well, too.
I didn't see that. Let's do it.
Okay. So you state that people have pain when the weather changes. Oh, okay. Well, I think that Dr. Schubiner would be better to answer that than me.
Yeah. Can you say it?
Yeah, I can answer the question. So the thing is that you have pain when the weather gets cold because your brain sees the weather change as dangerous. Your neck has some damage to it, had some damage to it from whatever injuries you had and the surgery that you had, but that damage has healed. All injuries heal. Surgical injuries heal. And so it doesn't matter that you had those in the past. The fact that the weather is causing changes in your pain is evidence that it's mind-body. I think that's simple.
I'm just asking the questions from new people rather than a second question from Susie. So from Sophia, can you have chronic pain that it's not caused by repressed emotions but central sensitization?
Yes. As I was saying earlier, not everyone has to deal with emotions or, quote, repressed emotions to get better. Central sensitization is another medical term for what I would call a mind-body condition. So they're the same to me. Central sensitization is curable, is a mind-body condition, is neural circuits, is changeable. So if you read that central sensitization is incurable, the people who are writing that don't understand our work. So the answer is yes, and that's why a lot of people can be helped, can have their pain resolved by doing this pain reprocessing work and not necessarily have to do deep emotional or work related to emotions. So the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. Now, Susie's question was, is your work effective no matter how long the pain has been? And the answer is yes. That's simple. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me ask a question, because I know a lot of people deal with this, and you might not see this on your end because of where you're at with your career, but I know that, you know, Rose and I see it, and other coaches and therapists and see it. You know, a lot of people, I am 100% believing of self-healing. People can, remember Dr. Sarno said that 5% of the people will need therapy. Remember he said that everyone can take care of it on their own, and around 5% will need some help. So, you know, I'm always, this show is about self-healing. Take this information, read the books. Please, there's a doctor in you. There's a psychologist in you. There's a Dr. Schubiner in you. There's a Rose in you. There's a Dr. Tova in you that can help yourself. But there are people that, you know, do need, like, what I call the collective ego to come in and take the course that you're teaching, or to do the therapy Rose and I are doing, or to go to tell me about your community and get some help from the community. Is that also a personal thing? I mean, some people are just going to need help. Okay, well, that's kind of what I was getting at, but, you know, I mean.
Well, you know, everyone's different, and some people need a lot of help for a long time. Some people need a little help for a little time. Some people do it on their own. Some people do it on their own, and then 5 years later, they need a lot of help.
Right. We call it a journey. We call it a journey. I mean, it's not like it ends. It's kind of an ongoing journey of what you called, you know, manage and moderate and hold and stabilize.
Yeah, it's the journey of humanness, right? It's the journey of being a human. It's the fact that we'll always be human, we'll always have a brain and a body, there'll always be interactions between those, there will always be stress in our lives, there will always be challenges in our lives that, you know, we have to deal with in the best way that we can. And, you know, I mean, I just like to say we're all bozos on this planet. You know, we're just trying to do the best we can, and that certainly includes me.
I really adore your humbleness. Like Moses. Rose, because we're going to say goodbye to in a few minutes, but Rose, maybe you want to say a few things.
About?
Dr. Schubiner's going to have to leave at 4 o'clock to get back to work. And so I didn't know if you wanted to say anything to our listeners.
Well, I just want to thank him. Thank you for coming. And also, we'll answer all the questions anyway that are up there.
Yeah.
So that... we can, if there's anyone wants to.
Yeah.
It's the morning here in Melbourne, so the rest of you are in the afternoon and evening, but I'm starting my day. So you're welcome to ask any questions and join us next week when we have Kayleen Hay coming on.
Yeah.
And thank you, Dr. Schubiner.
And Dr. Schubiner, I think I have one from Dr. Schechter and also from Dr. Clark from PBDA, the sheet that the questions that you ask. So maybe I'll email you for that.
The PPDA has a really nice one.
And
one of the, they have a patient brochure. I think it's a diagnosis brochure. It's very nice.
Okay, great. Okay, terrific. Well, listen, thank you for your time and having your lunch with us. I appreciate it. You'll let your wife know you're going to be starved when you get home. So appreciate it. And we hope to see you in our countries sooner than later.
Yeah, I had a plane to Israel and Australia in 2020. So both of those have been delayed.
Wow. It's just temporary. And if Rose and I can help you with anything ever in your work, we're like-minded. And there's so many people that are getting it, Dr. Schubiner. So many people, every day people are just like, hey, I got it. It's the Schubiner thing. I got it. They're getting it. Unlearn your pain, unthink your pain.
Hal Greenham and I are starting a second virtual online live training program for people who are therapists or coaches or other health professionals who are, you know, acupuncturists, massage therapists, educators, anyone who's working with folks, if they're interested in that course. It's at freedomfromchronicpain.com.
Excellent. And also, I want to say one thing. I went to your website. You have this amazing doctor, Dr. Joe Tato, that you're working with. He looks, I don't hear much about him.
I don't know that he's on my website. But anyway,
you're on his website.
Oh, okay.
You're on his website.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, Joe, I think he's a physical therapist. He's a really good guy. He's got a lot of great ideas. He endorses some things that I don't quite as much, you know.
Yeah.
Like he does a lot of food and nutritional work, which is good, but I don't, you know, it's just not part of my work in terms of mind-body work. But
wonderful, wonderful. Okay, so we'll talk again soon, and thanks so very much. Okay.
Thanks a lot.
All the best.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank
bye-bye.
You.
Bye. Rose, on a little bit. Rose, you want to stay on a little bit and chat a little bit with anybody that's still here?
Oh, okay.
Do you want to say goodnight? Yeah. So there was the only question I didn't get to ask. Does anyone else have a question for Rose or I? We're just happy to see all the people that have come to visit. There was a question from Miguel. Am I saying it correctly? Maybe we can help the answer and then send it to Dr. Schubiner. I took pain medication 4 times a day, but every time I took a pill, I felt overwhelmed with feelings of guilt. Full stop.
Do you want to comment on that?
No, I want you to. Do I stop the medication in order to heal? Go ahead, because you're the nurse. You're the nurse, Rose.
Sure. Every time, I would be more inclined to wonder about what was going on behind the scenes, Miguel, because there's something happening that's creating that guilt. Because you're having the medication to stop the pain, but my guess is that it isn't stopping the pain. And I'm wondering if the guilt is that this isn't going to help me. Maybe I need something else. I think that's probably the best way. And do I have to stop the medication to order a heal? I never tell people to stop their medication. But what I notice is they stop it themselves.
Yes.
And that's, I know then their healing process has begun.
Excellent.
And sometimes they'll go to the doctor and the doctor will say, oh, don't give it up. And I always say, well, You know, that's up to you. You can heal despite the medication. So
excellent. Barbara Klein, what about blood pressure, Barbara? What was your question about blood pressure? I'm not sure. Oh, is high blood pressure a mind-body condition? Well,
yes.
High blood pressure is absolutely your heart and your... Go ahead, Rose. Go ahead. I want you to answer that.
Oh, thank you. The blood pressure has been raised because of anxiety. And unfortunately, it's not recognized. And also, often people with chest-type pain also have stomach pain. And the vasovagal system, actually, that's the pathway. So a person with stomach problems often has a sort of tightness in their chest, or they'll have sort of fluttering. But unfortunately, because all the medical system is all in compartments, none of them talk to one another. So high blood pressure, you could say, is, and also that whole cholesterol story, mm-hmm. is about tension in the smooth muscle of the blood vessel. So, yes.
100%.
So, yeah.
And how many times?
You may have to take medication, but the medication is only camouflaging your real anxiety and fear.
Right, exactly. And then your body has a conditioned response of responding to the medication. And so when people say, my blood pressure is fine, I'm taking medication. How could their blood pressure be fine if they're taking medication? So it becomes that we condition our body. So it's, and everyone that, not everyone, but so many doctors I talk to, if their patients go on medication and go off the medication, exercise or watch their weight, or and all those things have an emotional response. When I lose weight, when I gain weight, when I exercise, when I don't, when I meditate, when I don't.
Yeah.
This is a good question from Stella. I have unconditioned pain response while sleeping. And pain wakes me up. How can I control my unconscious pain mind while sleeping?
That's interesting. Well, my guess is that it's got something to do with your dreaming, and then dreaming about you really having nightmares or something like that.
Right.
And probably if you want to talk to me, my phone number is there somewhere, and on WhatsApp.
Yeah.
And I can talk to you about that, because obviously there's some turmoil going on in your life and something you need to address, and finding that is probably where you need to go, because the pain response, waking up in pain, because most patients will say, I don't have pain when I immediately wake up. And then other patients will say, I've wakened up in the middle of the night in pain. Right. And on seeing patients over the years, my internal idea is that it's been a dream, because your unconscious is more free when your neocortex is asleep.
Right. What I learned is that when you relax to go to sleep, everything relaxes, but what's not relaxed. So what appears, is a muscle, is a back, is a neck, is an arm, and if it's my unconscious, it's saying, I need attention. Give me something, do something, be something, breathe. So in our sleeping, we can't really respond to it, and it becomes, you know, more of a negative experience. So, you know, Rose and I give anyone who's interested complimentary consultations to help them on their journey. If anybody would like to, you can always find us on TMS Roundtable. The Facebook page you're on now. Also, if anybody has questions, particularly for Dr. Schrubiner, you can put them on our Facebook page, TMS Roundtable Talks, and or TMS Roundtable, and we will send him the questions. I think he was very open to be there for anyone.
Yeah. Could I respond to Julia Winner as well? Do you have an answer why we get problems in different parts of the body?
Julia? Yeah, hold on. I'll get the question.
Okay.
I'll get the question.
I think everyone can see them anyway.
Oh, yeah. What was Julia's question? It was back here. Go ahead.
Yeah. why you get them in different parts of the body.
Yes.
I think that Dr. Schubiner actually covered that quite well, in as much as it's the tension in the muscle or whatever, and it goes to different areas in the body. So, you know, it could be one system, or it could be, you know, patients will say, you know, if it was an actual physical problem, would only be on one side of the body, but it can be on both sides of the body. And that reminds us that it's about a mind-body issue.
Right.
So,
Rose, you know, in like the original mind-body work in California, Louise Hay would tell us that a certain emotion would mean a certain organ or a certain system. So that's another way to look at it.
And Dr. Schubiner's comment before about having a problem at work, like a man that anger, what the anger would want to do to that person, and then allowing that to sort of like come up in your mind and then be at peace with it, because that's what the anger wants to do. Not that the anger will do it, but if the anger could be let free and not connected to the person and the person's mind and body,
exactly,
that's what the anger would want to do.
Exactly.
So, yeah, thank you for that question.
Karen had asked about, does the work help phantom pain?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I mean, especially, yeah. I mean, it's something we all learn about, the phantom leg, and, you know, he has a conditioned response. He expects to wake up with pain. So the leg is not there. And his neuropathway says, "Where I have pain." So what I learned this from Dr. Hanscom's work, we have to add a new pathway. We don't take away that pathway. Yes, he's used to having leg pain, but the leg is gone. So what we have to do is build a new pathway that says, "I don't have a leg. I can, you know, I'm healthy." And I think that's all. That's the neurophysiological work that Dr. Schubiner talks about, and, you know, what we call the brain pain and the fight and flight system. It's wonderful knowledge. It's very intellectual work. So I know Rose and I feel like the intellectual work is good, but the heart and soul feeling work is as important. You know, what do you think? Would you add something to that, Rose, about like the phantom pain? There's a loss. I mean, the person has a limb that's gone. The person has a part of the body that's gone. There's an emotional connection to that.
I'd take a different approach, in actual fact. I'd be saying that it's about anxiety. It's about fear.
Good.
And the fear of the pain. And we'll use a leg, for example, because often with patients with diabetes, and they have to have part of their foot or their toe amputated, whatever, because of necrosis. And the pain of that numb feeling that hasn't gone away. So it's about the fear of the numb feeling. And Dr. Schubiner actually brought that up quite solidly about how strong the fear is that the pain will come back. And I didn't get a chance to ask him about anticipatory, because he does a whole lot of expansion on anticipatory pain. Or he did actually mention it, but... Yeah. The whole idea that if I bend over, I'm going to be in pain.
Yeah.
Or if I'm going to visit my mother-in-law, I'm going to be in pain.
Yeah.
So all of that anticipatory stuff is creating the phantom pain. So in actual fact, the neural pathway is open to have all these things corralled in, I suppose you might say.
Yeah.
You know, all the different symptoms can all be corralled in and go back behind that, and it's going to be about fear of change, fear of another person, fear of speaking up, fear of my own inadequacy or whatever, or fear of judgment, or all of those things. They're all a whole bunch of fears, and it doesn't matter where they fit into the picture, but they're all coming from that same area. So, you know, if you think about an amputated foot or toe, I'm going to have a walking stick for the rest of my life. I'm going to have to wear a prosthesis for the rest of my life. I mean, how much fear is that?
Right.
And I'm not going to be able to go dancing anymore.
I'm different. I'm embarrassed. I'm different. I'm not like everyone else.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, they're the areas that I'd be. Now, for Senga, I don't know what allodynia is. Do you, Tova?
Look, it's what's it called when the hair comes out? I'm not sure I know what it is either.
No, look, Senga, the what all I can say is that it's all about the anxiety and fear,
right?
And if you look at how we respond to anxiety and fear, we have three pathways. And unfortunately, it's not actually mentioned by most of these doctors. But if it was, it would allay the fear, because striated muscle is things like fibromyalgia. Gastroparesis is smooth muscle anxiety. Urinary tract infections are smooth muscle anxiety. All of these things, skin conditions are, again, an anxiety pathway. People have brain fog after COVID, as Dr. Schubiner was talking about, but he actually didn't mention that that's an anxiety pathway. It's a very well-known anxiety pathway.
Yeah. So, you know, Gail mentioned that allodynia.
Oh, yes. Thanks, Gail.
I think it is.
Yes.
And we're talking about CRSP or RSD. It's that hyper or hypo or non-feeling, which is the brain protecting.
Yes. I didn't know that there was such a thing as allodynia, but I've written about that on our TMS roundtable the other day about not being able to recognize sensations. And I can't remember without looking at my notes at what it's called. But people can't actually feel their heart.
Wow.
They can't feel their heartbeat. And that's one of the ways of spotting that. And of course, that's another TMS type problem.
Right.
So unfortunately, the anxiety, and it's usually from childhood, mm-hmm. that it sort of remains in us, mm-hmm. Allows us to just think in our heads and stay in our heads because we're safe there. And then until they have therapy or recognize it themselves, they then begin to realize that they've got a heartbeat,
right.
and that it gets. They can right. notice when it's stronger,
right.
but they can't notice the resting heart,
right.
which is about, you know, being the vasovagal system being dormant
right.
at peace.
So Senga Queen says that it's from nerve damage. And, you know, I wanted to ask Dr. Schubiner, like, is nerve damage permanent? And whether he said yes or no, again, we know that the response to nerve damage is what we are. We can change drastically. 1,000%. I mean, one person will act different to nerve damage than the other person will act different to nerve damage.
Okay, there's another way of looking into it too, Tova, and that is if you've got nerve damage, you're going to have a whole lot of signs to show it.
Right.
You're going to be able to, you're going to have a withered leg or whatever. You're going to be paralyzed if you've got nerve damage.
Right.
You know, and that sort of thing. But the nerve damage could be original, like happen originally. But in actual fact, those nerves become, I don't know if they compensate or whatever, but there's a whole lot of compensatory stuff that goes on in the brain and the nerves. And there's a book called The Brain That Changes Itself. I can't remember the author. Wow. But that also goes with the nerve damage.
Yeah.
And there was a movie, I can't remember, was it called Heal?
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor or whatever had a terrible traumatic car accident with a lot of nerve damage.
Mm-hmm.
And with meditation, I think, and mm-hmm. mind-body sort of disposition, he actually healed.
Right.
Can you remember the name of that movie? I can't.
Heal.
Was it Heal?
Heal.
Was it Heal? It should have been Heal. Yeah.
I am sure, I am positive that people can have nerve damage and the strength of their belief and the strength of their will can absolutely have the body react different, and compensation from other nerves helping out. I know that scientifically it's available. And if someone's like nerve damage means the end, that's their projection. So that's an interesting topic we could talk about. Is nerve damage permanent? And I don't think it's a science. I think it's an art. And I think, again, the body-mind philosophy will take you far, far, far. So I'm thrilled to have had so many people come and watch. Like I said, if anyone has any question for Dr. Schubiner,
that we have an answer or whatever.
Send it to him if you want a specific answer from him. Though I just love the way he spoke so much about emotions and compassion. And he was just right on it. He was just right on it, Rose. He was just, I was so excited. Really, really happy for us to be able to have him on and for him to take an hour. You know, he goes on to everyone. I see him on everywhere. I think he's just so giving with his time and energy. He's a real healer, true and true.
Yeah. All right. Well, good morning, everyone. Good evening, everyone.
Yeah.
And please join us next week when we've got Kayleen Hay.
Yeah.
She actually has a lovely little book she's written, and I'm really looking forward
to chatting to her.
Yeah. Wonderful. And she recently had a fall, but she's going to come on anyway. And I think that's
because she's resilient. Okay, everybody. So good to see you. Hopefully we'll see you around the Facebook environment or again next week. Good night, Rose. Good morning, Rose.
See you, Tova.
Bye.
Bye. Bye, everyone.